So I was asked to lead some discussion on gravitational waves in the very early universe. And as you may know, and as you will see also in this talk, the direct detection of gravitational waves from the early universe is still quite ahead of us. There are mainly two reasons for this. One is the gravitational force is really very tiny, very weak. And indeed, if you think of, for example, a gravitational wave that has been emitted during slow roll inflation, for example, and today has a frequency of 100 Hz, will induce a displacement on a free mass of the order of 10 to the minus 22nd centimeter. That is quite small. So technically, it's very complicated to detect them. And also, the second point is that I should say that we don't know also a lot of, so we lack of knowledge of a lot of physical processes in the very early universe. And so this makes also the predictions not very robust. So in this talk, I will try to address these three items. So which physics we can learn by detecting gravitational waves. So which physics can we probe? How robust are the current predictions, and if and how we can improve them? And along the talk, I will also mention the capabilities and timescales of current and future experiments for gravitational waves, so that you can have an idea of how long we need to wait to detect ready gravitational waves. So let's start from a more optimistic point of view, the experiments that now have been built and are now working, although not at design sensitivity. So there is now an international network of gravitational wave interferometers that will be sensitive to the frequency band between 10 and 1 kilohertz. One is in Louisiana, two interferometers are in Hanford in Washington State. We have also an interferometer in Italy called Virgo. It's a French-Italian collaboration. There is an interferometer in Germany. The interferometer in France and in the US are 4 kilometer length, while the one in Geo is a little bit smaller, 600 meter. There is one in Japan, 300 meter, that already has taken data and has worked at design sensitivity. And on the other hand, while these interferometers will be sensitive to gravitational waves over a broad range of frequency, there are also other kind of detectors, resonant bar detectors, that will be that are just cylindrical shape objects that will be which oscillation frequency is driven by the gravitational wave, and they will be sensitive very narrow band and sensitive around 1 kilohertz. And there are various of them in several parts of the world. Now, just to show you that indeed the interferometers are working, this is the noise spectral density as a function of the frequency. So this is the noise that you have at the output of the interferometer. This is the interferometer in Louisiana, the 4 kilometer one. And these curves, so this curve here is the gold sensitivity, is the sensitivity at which the first interferometer should work, okay? And these lines here are the noise curves that have been changing during the time, starting from, you don't read here, this was May 2001, this one, when the interferometer was first locked. And now, in January 2003, the sensitivity is this one in blue. So it's approaching the gold sensitivity, but it's still not, it's still a few order of magnitude above. By the way, this is not the end of the story, because it's not only important to see this plot, it's also important to understand for how long they can keep this sensitivity in the interferometer. So what they call the duty cycle, because very often you get this sensitivity for a few hours and then it gets worse again. Okay. So, and to conclude this first part, I want to show you, because this was done in January 2003, it takes some time that transpires to come out. Okay, and now for the first time, the data for the first, what has been called the first scientific run, have been analyzed. This is a scientific run that was done in September 2002. And now there are some few papers of the LIGO scientific collaboration that are out. They went out this summer. And here I'm plotting again the characteristic strain, I mean the noise. This is the gold one, and this is what they had during the first scientific run. And with this line is indicated the gravitational wave signal that you expect from binary systems made of neutron stars at 100 kiloparsec or 100 megaparsec. And this is the same for the other interferometer, the Hanford one, and this is for GEO. Okay? This scientific run and the analysis of the data was done only to put some upper limits because you are very far from any kind of detection. Okay? But it was done to check all the algorithms and start doing some data analysis. And upper limits were put on various astrophysical sources like the binary system, pulsars, and also on the stochastic background. Okay. So this is the current state of the experiment, and now let's start. I forgot. Okay, so there is another experiment that will fly in the space. It's called LISA. It will be sensitive to frequency between 10 to the minus 4 and 0.1 Hz. It's very complementary to the ground-based interferometers because the kind of sources that we'll see, as we will see in the following, is very different. It's a mission between the European Space Agency and NASA and should fly in 2011, sorry, and is made by three drag-free spacecraft that track the motion of the mirrors that are inside them, track the, sorry, the distance between the spacecraft using laser light. And the distance between them is something of the order of 5 million of kilometers. Okay. So let's start looking on the contrary, on the theoretical side. What are the characteristic intensity and the frequency that we expect from Rayleigh gravitational waves? So there are various mechanisms that can produce gravitational waves. For the moment, just to give an orientation, I will just describe what is the intensity and the frequency from any causal mechanism that could have produced gravitational waves. But then I will focus on gravitational waves from inflation, and like the Sitter kind inflation, is roll-on inflation, and also from these bounce universe scenarios. But then I will also discuss gravitational wave from first-order phase transitions occurring in the early universe, cosmic strings, and finally also a way that through gravitational wave we can get information about the cosmological parameter. So here I want just to introduce some quantity, and since for the sources I will discuss, generally these are stochastic backgrounds, the intensity is generally described by this quantity omega, that is just d rho over d log f, well, rho is the energy, the zero-zero component of the energy momentum tensor, average of on some wavelength. And just to, when sometimes I will show the plot, of the noise, I will just evaluate from the, I mean, once you have the displacement of the mirrors in the interferometer, you can connect this displacement to the noise spectral density, and then from the noise spectral density you can evaluate the equivalent omega, okay? Okay, so first, there are some phenomenological bounds that are quite important, that also is important to keep in mind, that constrain the amplitude of the gravitational wave spectrum. So one of them is the so-called Big Bang nucleosynthesis bound. So here I'm plotting again omega as a function of the frequency. Here you see also how big is the range of frequencies we will be interested in, from 10 to the minus 18 Hz to something to 10 to the 10 Hz. And this bound is due to the fact that at the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, when the light elements will form, we don't want, the rate of expansion of the universe cannot be very high. There is a bound on it, otherwise you will produce too many neutrons, and the neutrons will overproduce helium, and so you will spoil all the results of Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So you have to put a bound on the amount of gravitational waves that are present at the time of nucleosynthesis. And this bound is this, and then will give rise to this line here, so around 10 to the minus 6. Then you have a bound that comes from the inhomogeneities in the cosmic microwave background radiation, and through the Sachs-Wolfe effect, and here the bound interest frequency that were outside of the horizon at the time of decoupling and the inside of the horizon today. So this is the bound from COBE. And there is another important bound that comes from millisecond pulsars. And actually, millisecond pulsars are really like gravitational wave detectors because they emit, neutron stars that spin, that have highly magnetic fields around them, and they emit light. They are like lighthouse in the sky, and every time the light encounters they rotate, so when the light encounters the Earth, you detect the signal the pulse from them. Now, if a gravitational wave passes through the radio pulsar and us, it will introduce a Doppler shift in the light, and so it will change the time between one pulse and the other, and so you can put very very precise bounds on it, and also because observation has been done for a lot of years, something like 8 years, and so this is the bound that comes from the millisecond pulsars. Okay.
Any number of neutrinos?
Is the number of effective neutrinos, not really neutrinos, but...
It's the upper bound.
Hmm?
It's the upper bound, right?
Yes, it's the upper bound.
That's how much room is left on any other kind.
Yeah.
Just thinking about this Big Bang nucleosynthesis bound, it's not obvious to me that it's the same bound...
At every frequency?
At all frequencies, right?
Okay, so this I didn't say, I skipped this part, but it's just because... Okay, so this integrand here is positive, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, the only way you can have something that it's not like flat like this is you have some omega that is zero everywhere, yeah, except for a very narrow band.
I was actually thinking about the fact that there's a difference between frequencies. Is there not a difference between frequencies that are inside the horizon and at the time of nucleosynthesis and outside the horizon? Is there any difference to the effect of that?
When you evaluate this bound, you assume that only gravitational waves that have been produced before Big Bang nucleosynthesis.
Right. So, but that wouldn't then apply all the way, because the left-hand side here is modes that are just at horizon, just coming inside the horizon today. So they've been outside the horizon at the time of nucleosynthesis.
But I think that's super
horizon
scale
at that time.
You mean that there is really no bound on the low frequency part.
Yeah.
The integral should only be over the right hand part of the spectrum. Because those are the frequencies which are inside the horizon.
But you mean you are wondering about the upper bound, the integration?
How far in frequency that really extends, whether it really applies to.
Oh, okay. So you are saying that in this curve here, I should have cut it.
Yeah,
you are right. I didn't understand. Yeah, this was just me that I put a bound for. But with PowerPoint do it. No, you are right. Yeah, precisely right. Okay.
And another quick question. So the millisecond, the frequency for a millisecond.
That comes just from the distance between us and the millisecond pulsar?
No, this frequency here actually is the inverse of the observation time, for how long we have observed the pulsar.
Oh.
It's actually, in fact, it's the inverse of 8 years time.
It's a very long, like a gradual shift in the...
Yeah. Okay. So coming back to here, I just wanted to, just as an orientation, so suppose that, so there are actually two features that determine the typical frequency of the gravitational wave. So one is the dynamics and one in the kinematics. So the dynamics, of course, is model dependent. And the kinematics is just the redshift from the era in which the gravitational wave is produced up to now. Now, suppose that the graviton is produced at time t star with a certain frequency during radiation matter era, and suppose that it was produced by some causal mechanism. Now, the frequency today, you get it just redshifting the frequency at time t star. And now, if you assume that the evolution is adiabatic, and you also assume that the length of the gravitational wave is, few times smaller, I mean, it's epsilon, the radius of the Hubble horizon at that time, because if it was produced by causal mechanism, you can assume that lambda is a little bit smaller or equal to h star minus 1. Actually, in this epsilon is contained all the information about the dynamics, so about the model, no, that you are the mechanism that produced the gravitational wave. Then you get a frequency that is just this quantity here. And when you plot, for example, you do a plot like this, in which you try to understand in this big plot where the space and ground-based interferometers are as a function of the frequency, and here as a function of the temperature at the time in which it was produced, you easily see that, for example, ELISA, with this mechanism, we can probe physics in the TeV, and the ground-based interferometers more in 10 to 10 GeV, for example, and for the Planck temperature or scale, you have to go at very high frequency. By the way, every time, sometimes I will have like Virgo and then LIGO 1, LIGO 2, and even LIGO 3. So LIGO 2 will be an upgrade of LIGO, for which a lot of research and development has been already done. And we know, and there is an official noise curve for it, that is the one that I'm plotting here. And it should be operative in 2008, while Euro and LIGO 3, the R&D started only more recently. So here I'm just plotting one of the examples of the optical configuration that have been worked out. So this is not very, it's just an indication of how we can push the, using the facilities of LIGO, how much we can push really this noise curve. Okay? Okay, so now let's start from, yes.
About the previous plot, the quantity you plotted, the log of omega, how
log of
did you get these quantities from simply the omega in the spectral density?
Yeah, so actually here I'm not, here I'm not doing any correlation between the interferometers. Okay. Because, this is another important point. So when you want to measure a stochastic background of gravitational waves, since this is a stochastic signal, and since you have also the noise in the interferometer that has maybe a Gaussian distribution, it's like Gaussian noise, then you have to discriminate between the two of them. And the only way you can do it, since your signal is much lower than the noise, is to try to do correlations between two interferometers. And if you do correlation, you can increase this omega by a factor that is the bandwidth multiplied by the observation time to a power 1 over 4. So I will show afterwards some curves in which this will go down here. Because with the ground-based interferometer, you have more than one detector. The problem is with LISA that for the moment there is only one. You can do only, you cannot do correlations with LISA. Okay. So here let's start with a signal from inflation. and so the stochastic background. I will go quite quickly on these few transparencies because yesterday Brian Green gave a nice already introduction of this. So here I want just to say that actually it's quite easy to work out the metric perturbation in isotropic and spatially homogeneous Friedman-Robertson-Walker background. Since the metric perturbation do not couple to matter. So the equation that they satisfy is very simple, is this one, where A is just the scale factor. And then generally, so the mechanism that produce gravitational wave is you can easily derive from a quantum point of view if you just promote this H to be a quantum field, and then you introduce annihilation and creation operators. And since your space-time, the gravitational field is varying in time, you amplify quantum fluctuation as in other as is a very generic phenomena. So generally, you have two cosmological phases. One is inflation, and the second one can be radiation or matter. You have two scale factors, two vacua, and there is this transformation called Bogoliubov transformation between the annihilation and creation operators in the two era. And at the end, because of the mixing of the positive and negative mode between the two cosmological phases, you get a beta that is generically different from zero. And the gravitational wave omega here is proportional to the number of particles that are produced that depends on beta in this way. So here in this formula, actually, I'm assuming that at initial, so when you give the initial condition, you also assume that there are some that the vacuum is not, that the state is not a vacuum. But otherwise, for example, in Dutch-Davis vacuum, you put this n equal to zero and you get just a beta square. Okay? Actually, this is more from the quantum point of view, but semi-classically also, as Brian Green was showing yesterday, if you just redefine the variable h, you get a very simple equation for this quantity psi. So it's just a Schrödinger equation with a potential that depends on time. And you can have two situations. Either kappa square is much larger than this potential that depends on the variation in time of the scale factor. And so you get like oscillation modes. So oscillation modes that are always outside actually inside your horizon. And they decay like 1 over A. Or you have for kappa much smaller than the barrier of the potential, then you get this solution here, and in general this term is subdominant, and so H is constant, and this occurs when the fluctuation goes outside the Hubble radius, so in this region here. Now, a first example that I want to discuss is so the simplest case is the case in which you take, for example, slow roll inflation, in which the Hubble parameter is almost constant. Actually, h minus 1 is slightly increasing in time. And here you have the transition to radiation and matter. Okay? And so if one, let's for the moment look at very large scales, so fluctuations that went out of the horizon quite soon and they re-enter in the matter era, for example, the one that are important for the CMB. So since the Hubble radius is almost constant, actually what you get is that the omega is just h, at the time of exit, and then there is a very mild dependence on the frequency, but the exponent is really very small. And so if you now want to look at the gravitational spectrum that you get from slow roll inflation, you can have a plot in which you have omega as a function of the frequency. So here I'm extrapolating, so you are maybe familiar with this parameter S and T, the contribution of the scalar part and the tensorial part to the CMB. So this is V, the potential at the time of exit, or the, when the fluctuation exits from the horizon. And T, if we use, normally it's just given by minus the ratio between T and S. This is the spectral index of the tensorial spectrum. And that can also vary a little bit, can also depend on kappa. And I'm fixing, for example, for this plot, t over s equal to 0.18. And I'm also varying in these two lines. I'm assuming that there is also a running of n as a function of kappa, either actually 0 or 10 to the minus 3. Yeah? And then here you have the result if you put t over s 0.0018. I remind you that we don't know what is t over s. So for the moment, this is a free parameter. So I want. So this figure shows you that indeed, with the current estimation of the noise curve of LISA and with the interferometers even doing correlation between them, you are a few order of magnitude above these lines here. And also, I have to add here that this line that I call white dwarf stochastic background, is an astrophysical stochastic background that is present due to the fact that there are many binaries made of white dwarf in our galaxy, and there are so many that you cannot resolve them, and so they will appear like a stochastic background. And so this means that you have, even if the signal would have been much higher, you have to find a way of subtracting this stochastic background. Otherwise, you won't be able to detect the gravitational wave signal from inflation. There are ways in which you can subtract this, and indeed, Carlo Ungarelli also, together with Vecchio, pointed out a possibility of doing it. That is, the primordial stochastic background is isotropic, while the one from the white dwarf binaries is not isotropic because it's mainly distributing in the galactic plane. So if you could be able to, discriminate the two backgrounds using evaluating the multiples in the stochastic background. Okay, so this is a possibility. However, people, just to have an idea of how long we have to wait to detect gravitational waves, so I want to show you also that people are already thinking about designing a post-LISA mission, so after LISA that is still not working, but but things have to be done in advance. So this proposal that actually Carlo was telling me has been now became really a proposal to do some R&D and has been sent to NASA. It's called something like the Big Bang Observatory, and is the following. So they are designing a mission in which the noise curve of LISA will be pushed here, so the knee will be moved at a higher frequency to avoid the part of the galactic binary background. Although here you have also another background that is made of neutron star binaries, but they are not so many, so you can hope to subtract it. And then you have this noise curve, very nice, but since you are not at the prediction of inflation, if t over s is 0.18, so to go from here to here, then is very challenging. You have to do correlation between two LISA. And so you have really two things, correlation between two LISA, and also increase the laser power that you use in the spacecraft, augment the dimension of the mirrors. So there are a lot of, it's very challenging, but people are already starting thinking about building something that will really have as a goal the detection of this background. Although I should say that t over s is not known, so it could be even much lower.
It's okay? A bound, no? Huh? The upper bound? T over, this is the upper bound?
I think, yes. Now people say that t over s is 0.1, something like that. I don't think, I don't know if there are people from CMB here. Hmm?
I thought it was discussed here. You don't know offhand, Andre, what is the present over S, 10%?
I wouldn't say.
Okay.
Certainly not one, no?
Mm-hmm. No.
Over S. So, I mean, you cannot push it up.
What is the price of this experiment? What is the price of this experiment?
I don't know. I mean, this experiment will use four LISA, so four four of these triangular laser interferometers, because you need two of them to do correlation and other two to localize the neutron star binary and subtract them. So it's very challenging and very, I guess it's... Yes.
They're cheaper if you get them in bulk.
But I think, I mean, in maybe 20 years, maybe 30 years, it's important that people start thinking about it.
Polarization measurements at CMB will tell us about C over S long before this, right?
Yes, I had the transparency. but also here there are problems because, okay, so another way of detecting, so if we want to look at the imprints of gravitational waves in the CMB, and we want to get really the only the mode that contains only gravitational waves, we have to do polarization measurements of the photons of the CMB. Now, recently, during the last year, there were a few papers that went out in which they were pointing out that, unfortunately, there is a contamination due to the weak gravitational lensing. And so so if you look actually in the paper, especially in this paper of Kesden and Kure and Kamionkowski, they show at the end, they conclude that if we don't subtract this weak gravitational lensing effect, the minimum inflation energy that you will get is something like this, with the sensitivity of Planck, that is 1 microkelvin square root of second. So you cannot get values lower than measure. So what I'm saying is that if the potential at the time the fluctuation went out of the horizon was higher than lower than this value, you are covered by this weak gravitational lensing effect. And there was a talk of Liu's 2 weeks ago here. He also mentioned this fact. So also here is very delicate. It's not so people have been during the last year looking at possible estimators, as they call them, of for the weak gravitational lensing. But I talked with some people, Kamionkowski and Kesner, recently. But there is no clear way of tackling the problem, and so also there is delicate. Okay, so we have seen that with Strohl-Ola inflation or models around it that predict a flat spectrum for the gravitational wave are the one realized in nature, then it will be really very hard to detect them, or we have to wait a lot of years. So another possibility is to look at spectrum that increase as a function of the frequency. And there have been in the literature some examples, so I will want to discuss them. Also because in this case, it's also more interesting, and maybe in this case we can get some improvements improvement from high energy physics or string theory in general. So here I'm referring to models that had a pre-Big Bang history and in which the inflation is not provided by any potential, but just one has an accelerated contraction or accelerated expansion due to the kinetic energy of some field that could be, for example, a dilaton field This is the low energy limit, for example, of heterotic string theory in the dimension. And so there is this coupling between E to minus, between the dilaton R and the kinetic energy of the dilaton, as you know quite well. Now, this action has been used more than 10 years ago to derive solutions that have an inflationary stage. And generate, I mean, that give rise to this model that then has been called the Premier Bank model. And then it's also been used more recently by other people, and here are some of these people, who tried to also implement the idea of having some history before the Premier Bank, before the B-Bank. So here what I want to say is that, so given this action, if you go in four dimension, you, and this is the metric, you write the metric in this way, you take an homogeneous solution, and the solution of the equation of motion is very simple, it's a modified Kastner metric, and the Dirac field evolve in time like a log of t with some coefficient gamma that is determined by these two relations. This is just the generalized Kastner equation. If gamma is zero, you have just Kastner. And you can look at this solution in these two plots, where I'm plotting H in the string frame, and here there is this combination of the Dilaton and H, phi bar. And there are various possibilities. Either you follow this line here, in which, sorry, this line here, in which you start from a weak coupling universe and weak coupling, and also with H very small, and then you you go from a weak coupling to strong coupling. And then you would like to connect this branch to another branch in which from once you do the transition from negative time to positive times, then you enter something like Friedman-Robertson-Walker space time, you know, an expansion, a decelerated expansion. And this was the solution used in the Premier Bank model. And, and the other solution that also appeared quite interesting is this other one, in which, on the contrary, you start at negative time from strong coupling, and then you go toward weak coupling. But also here, you want to connect this part with this part here. And actually, are these connections that create problems. I mean, that are not, for the moment, completely clarified. But the difference between the two, from the point of view of the solution, is just that different choices of this alpha and gamma, and that's it. So let's look a moment at, so here I don't think I want to go into the details, but I want just to say that, so once you have, okay, I don't want to give many details. I want just to say that it's very simple to go through the evaluation of the tensorial perturbation, even when, I mean, you start from an action like this, because at the end you obtain an equation for your perturbation that has a still of this form, with a U, with a potential that depends now on not on the scale factor, but on what I'm calling here the pump field, this A tilde, that is a combination of the scale factor and your field, the Dilaton field. If you had other like moduli in your action, this will depend also on those moduli, if they are not static, if they are just dynamical, okay? And then, as you do in other for the other cases, you just consider two phases and you evaluate the solution of this equation in the two phases. And what you find at the end is that at the end the Bogoliubov coefficient depends on an index here, epsilon, that depends on the exponent of in these two phases here of the pump field. Okay, so it depends practically on the equation of state of that cosmological phase. And the spectral index of omega will depend also on this epsilon t. Okay, so now, at the end, if you have many phases, so for example, if you take, like in this case, you have at the beginning a phase in which you have an accelerated expansion, like here, and then you have the transition and you enter the radiation of Matteira, then you can evaluate the perturbations in these two phases, and you get the spectral slope that of the gravitational wave spectrum that depends only on this parameter epsilon, so only on the kinematics, on the coefficient gamma and gamma 2. But more delicate is the question of the spectrum, or the amplitude of the gravitational wave spectrum, because this amplitude can depend on the dynamics and also of many physical assumptions, like, for example, reheating, entropy production, etc. So what I'm saying here is just that So it's very easy to evaluate the spectral slope of the gravitational wave spectrum, because you can just, for example, in this case, in which for the Preby bang you have this accelerated expansion, h minus 1 decreases now in time, while for the slower inflation was almost constant. Then you enter a region that you don't know very well how to describe, and then you have radiation and matter. You can consider fluctuations that go out here and re-enter here, or go out here and re-enter here. And if you play this game, you get, for example, spectrum that are not at all flat all the way, so they can avoid the Kobe bound, and then they can have, they can erase like F cube. And here, they can be either flat or red or blue, okay? So now this seems very interesting, but the problem are the how robust are these predictions, and how this region here, that is the most interesting one because it can lie in the frequency band of the interferometer, how this part of the spectrum depends on the details of the transition between the pre-Big Bang history and the post-Big Bang. And this is something that is quite important, especially, I mean, the amplitude here also can depend on it. And I want to show this in one example. That is this the case of compactified Milne, because there was a paper that went out recently on the determination of the tensorial spectrum in this model. And there has been a lot of discussion here, led by Gabriele and also Ed, David, and Rami Brustein. I think next week Ed is going to give some talk on the bouncing universe, so we'll maybe describe this more in detail. But so here what I want to say is that, so remember, there were these two kinds of solutions, the one used in the Preby bang and the one used by the cyclic model or ekpyrotic people, no? And in that case, for the other solution, no, the Preby bang one, they could, so originally they were like in D dimension, then they embed this in 11-dimensional theory, and then from this 11-dimensional theory, what happens is that the metric in this 11-dimensional theory appears really like flat, okay? Actually, it's not really, so it's flat, but if you introduce, okay, this variable, it corresponds to a compactified Milne with a symmetry Z2. And you can see it in this plot here, so this will be all Milne, while you have to compactify, so at the end you compactify on a segment, and these two lines here corresponds to the two brains that they approach each other, and then they pass like this, and they reappear on the other wedge, okay? So also in this case, they, for this background, they evaluated the tensorial modes. And actually, in the limit in which k kappa, so the momentum in the y dimension, on the y direction is zero, and they obtain a very simple equation, as the others I was showing you. So it's very simple. You have two cosmological phases with these two scale factors. What happens to the gravitational wave? Are they produced? Are they not produced in this very simple space-time? They claim that they are not produced, and they use, so they did a calculation in which they started from, so in this cyclic model you have at the beginning a very slow contraction of your universe, and then after this very slow contraction in which the very slow contraction is due to the presence of a non-perturbative potential, you enter in this Milne universe. And then you have so these two scale factors, so you enter the contraction era, and then the expansion era, and then the radiation and the matter era. And they what I'm saying is that they evaluated the spectrum of tensorial modes, but they claim that there are no production of gravitational waves going from this region to this region here. And they did a calculation without encountering any kind of divergence. Okay? And so we have been trying to understand this problem, but still I think it's not clear, especially because in this background was analyzed by indeed Horowitz and Pulczyński, and they showed that this is unstable. So is it really possible to pass through the t equal to zero here? They don't include any back reaction, and they claim that everything is smooth. And they impose boundary condition on the waves in such a way you don't produce anything.
Sorry, when you say they, do you mean this, the recent paper by Turok and Steinhardt?
Yeah, I mean this paper here, in which they evaluated the stochastic spectrum, but also the paper by, I don't remember if it is Tolli and Turok, in which they do quantum fields in compactified Milne.
You mean the very recent one, or the
Steiner? Yeah,
Steiner. Yeah. So in that paper, they looked at the quantum field in Milne, and then they used the results of that paper to evaluate the spectrum.
But in this paper, they say that they're not including the back reaction.
Yes.
They don't say that the back reaction will be small and everything will be fine. They say that they're just not including
it.
They just don't include it. Yeah. And I think they will agree
that's
that.
That's not the reason for they're not getting gravitational.
But are there...
Right, if you close your eyes to the back reaction problem, there's a well-defined prescription for transporting linear perturbations through, which you can play with and compare with other reactions.
So for you, it's well-defined, the prescription?
If you ignore the orbital prescription gives a well-defined linear evolution, and it's physically meaningless, I think, for the reasons of that reaction, but if you want to ignore that problem, it does give a well-defined linear evolution.
Yeah, but most recent talk of Turok was the statement that they considered linear perturbation and they are not good, and so they are now working on non-linear perturbation.
Oh, really?
Yes. This was in Sweden. This was the last page of his talk.
And just today when we were driving to your talk here, we could not actually come to the university because the whole road was closed because the two drivers neglected that reaction.
Okay, but let's just a moment, because I still don't understand. So if I don't include a back reaction, no, and I want to evaluate the gravitational waves that are, if production of particles occur going from this region to this region, are you saying that you agree that there is no particle production?
In the recent paper that Neil was talking about in Sweden, they did have a new ingredient, which was how they do the matching between the linearized perturbation in the past and the linearized perturbation in the future. They claim the standard matching condition on a constant phi surface doesn't correspond to the actual brains meeting at the same time, and they have to...
But this was for scalar perturbation. The gravitational waves is slightly bigger because it's less of a question of surface. But there is, I think, still a question of how you match. In other words, they have to manage to kill that log. You see, they all agree that the log builds up during the negative time evolution. And then by some magic matching and by neglecting that reaction, they get rid of the log later on. And this corresponds to no particle production. Mm-hmm. And we are still wondering whether there is one problem or there are two.
Your chalk doesn't have any large T equals 0 plus.
Who? The other one.
H out
will have a similar log such that by the time you are at T equal 1 over H5, nothing happens. And this is the reentry. On the other hand, if you regularize the vector putting a little epsilon, instead of T you write square root of T squared plus epsilon squared, then you find that you get twice the log.
That's a different thing.
So instead of canceling, you add.
Right.
No.
Well, because they claim that from the point of view of higher dimensions, you have to embed this in Minkowski, so it's really like a gravitational wave that is passing, like in Minkowski, that doesn't, nothing happens, no, when...
Before you, or before.
Yeah, but what you showed is that there are all these, you cannot just put one particle in Minkowski.
But that's a separation. That will be important.
I mean, you cannot just say that it's one single momentum in Minkowski. No. This is the way you...
Yeah,
so the problem, even in Minkowski, is very big.
But so the problem is tricky because you see if so they evaluated the gravitational wave spectrum that actually has no phenomenological interest because it's really many order of magnitude below any ground space based detector even post LISA and so completely really, but it's more a question of principle in the sense that they get a spectrum that is this one. And this phase here corresponds to waves that went out of the horizon during this very slow contraction and re-entered during the expansion in Milne, okay? But then, and so and this also determined the peak here, the amplitude of the spectrum. But then if you regularize, suppose that I regularize the background, I don't go up to t equal to zero, okay? I go up to a certain value, and I redo the calculation imposing that the continuity of the perturbation at these two boundaries. Then I will get that particles are produced during the contraction phase of Milne, so when they exit during contraction and re-enter during expansion. And these gravitons, this part of the production will change this part and will also change the amplitude of this part. So so I have a problem in the sense that I don't understand why regularizing it, I get completely different answer.
Singularity, you have all kinds of ambiguities.
Yeah, I think that the ambiguity is ambiguous.
Is, yeah. You can easily come to any conclusion.
So anyway, it's so these backgrounds, this cosmology are very interesting because phenomenologically, because they give spectrum that can erase. But we need more input from theory to really work out robust prediction for this. Okay? And okay, so another possibility of having a spectrum that increases a function of the frequency and doesn't touch inflation in the sense that inflation is still the standard one, slow roll inflation, is to have some, as was originally pointed out by Grishuk in 1975, if we have soon after the end of inflation, instead of starting from a radiation era, we have something like an expanding phase with equation of state stiffer than radiation, for example, something like this. I call it non-standard, okay? And actually, one example of this is this quintessential inflation model, in which so you have originally a potential that gives you slow roll inflation, and then the potential has no minimum. The minimum is at infinity, okay? So the inflaton field continues to run, in this model you get reheating through amplification of quantum value fluctuations, so not from from oscillation, and you can have a non-standard era that is stiffer than radiation. And the omega, in that case, for fluctuations that go out here and re-enter in this era, go like increase as a function of the frequency. So this is also quite interesting because if you can arrange the parameters in such a way that you can have, for example, a spectrum that increases like this as a function of the frequency. Massimo Giovannini has been working a lot trying to see the phenomenological consequences of these models for ground-based interferometers. You are still few order of magnitude below, but I'm just saying that another way of producing non-flat spectrum is to have some era after the end of inflation that are not necessarily immediately radiation era, okay? I don't know this model of inflation, of quintessential inflation, what is the status of it, because there are so many models that sometimes I don't know, I cannot keep track of it, and maybe it's dead and I don't know.
Nothing is completely dead until you read about it in the newspaper. as for graviton production, actually for the very process of production, the only thing that you need is any equation of state different from radiation. Mm-hmm. So it may be less steep than radiation, they will also be produced. I just do not know how it will look like.
Okay.
But yeah, it's the only condition under which it is not produced is that you have curvature scale equal to zero, which is in the radiation dominated curve. Otherwise, they will also be produced.
No, but she's talking about what is the phase after inflation.
Yeah.
Can be
exactly.
Yeah, it's not produced, but it's produced with a flat spectrum.
No. If it is radiation, you see, the gravitons are produced because there is the term proportional to R in the equation of motion for the gravitational perturbations. So for the inflationary universe, this R is constant. For radiation-dominated universe, it's zero. Because it's traceless equation of state.
So they satisfy the free equation, the gravity after.
They are produced because they are not conformally invariant, and the derivation deviation from conformal invariance works when curvature scalar is not equal to zero. Just like with scalar field, you have this deviation from conformal invariance if curvature scalar is not zero. So for radiation-dominated universe, curvature scale is zero. For any other, it is not.
Mm. But are there other examples, like quintessential inflation, in which I can have a non-standard era after non-radiation?
Cold dark matter domination, for example. After preheating, after inflation, you have cold dark matter-dominated universe for quite a long time. So you can have it there. But I'm not quite sure that you can get any effect which would be higher than of inflation. That was surprising. Maybe that.
Well, what is surprising, here it works because this point here, the end point, is fixed by the fact that he is imposing that all the CMB photons are produced with the amplification of quantum fluctuation during during the era. It's not, you don't have a, they are not produced by normal reheating. You don't have that, so.
I mean, the origin of this effect is that by changing the dynamics after inflation, because you produce the gravitons during inflation, it's how they redshift relative to the dominant matter. If the gravitational wave, gravitons are behaving like radiation, then anything that's stiffer than radiation. You get this increase, this glued shape that appears in the spectrum for those nodes. So, if it would matter, it would go the other way. You'd have had a decrease.
Yeah, it will decrease. Of course, in this region here, for the moment, there are no planned detectors, although people are thinking about electromagnetic detectors in megahertz, gigahertz region. Okay, another thing, just one transparency on this, because yesterday we had the talk on this subject. So actually in the talk of yesterday, the focus was mainly on the CMB, but modulo the criticism of Starobinsky and Chakhov, if we assume that the initial condition differ from the ones of adiabatic vacuum, so what I'm saying is that I'm using the same prescription used yesterday by Brian Green. So I impose that only when the modes go out of this hypersurface lambda minus one, where lambda is the scale of a non-physics, I start considering the mode from here, no? And in a universe in which you have a pre-Big Bang history, H minus 1 is not constant, it's doing something like this, for example. And Could I expect also a modification of the gravitational wave spectrum at very small scales? Because yesterday the focus was mainly on very large scales. So the very small scales are the ones that go out from this surface at the very end. And if you have a model that even go up to an h that is not far from lambda, like in these bouncing scenarios, then the distance between these two points, that is actually the ratio between h dot divided by lambda, will be higher and higher for fluctuation for small scales, okay? And so I could imagine, I don't know, maybe, I don't know if nobody did this calculation for the frequencies of interest for space or ground-based interferometers, but I can imagine that there are corrections of this kind, where this now can be also not so small. And so one day, if we will see this spectrum, maybe we can also discriminate, I mean, we can even see this oscillation coming from this effect. Of course, modulo the Starobinsky.
But the Starobinsky, I think it's only against the first term, the linear term.
Yes, you're right.
I think if you say
that they are.
Start with a square, you can hardly argue that there are no corrections about the h of lambda squared. You can hardly argue that there are none.
But you're talking about a case where h is very big, right?
That's right. So that's why you don't need the first term.
Yeah, but wouldn't Starobinsky's objections apply to any effect like this that's very big? No, but I mean.
Because of gravity.
Well, I mean, supposedly they apply to any situation.
There are two kinds of effects that have to be distinguished, real particles and virtual particles. His objections apply to real particle effects.
Right.
And I think the real particle effects are exponentially small. Mm-hmm. The virtual particle effects, which are just ordinary higher operators, can be there.
Yeah. So you can put it like that. Although I'm not sure you can. You're sure you can distinguish the two? This was what Steve Gibbons was asking yesterday. I mean, suppose you change by factor of two this lambda, then what you attribute to initial conditions in one picture, you attribute to evolution in the other picture into higher dimensional behavior. So I think it's a little bit blurry.
Well, we should, that's a different discussion, but I think there is a real, well, you can look at the sky and see the difference.
I mean, you are sure that the Kraft-Funkian evolution produces just the adiabatic vacuum, in other words.
No, I'm not sure, but I think you have to do something pretty scandalous to make it not. But anyway, we should. This is a different discussion.
Okay.
But what is clear is if the whole effect is just in the effect of Lagrange, then the Starobinsky problem will not exist.
I think it's not true. That's what I'm saying. And yet it could be effects here, which is just the same as saying we don't quite understand the hypervertical regime, so we cannot predict things to.
Starobinsky just said exactly what Baczynski said. If you have adiabatic vacuum, then you do not expect much. But if you have any drastic violations, then the first place where you would look for it will be higher frequency limit rather than low frequency.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, so can I have 10 minutes more, because I still have a few. Because now let's consider other processes. I want just to review this, because I want to show you what are the predictions for these other physical processes. So the first one is from first order phase transition, so you could have the universe could have undergone a first order phase transition due to the breaking of symmetry of some physical model. And and if you have a first order phase transition via quantum tunneling, you have the nucleation of true vacuum bubbles, and then this bubble can collide, and the spherical symmetry is lost, so they can emit gravitational waves. And people have investigated if the signal from this effect can be interesting or not. I mean, can be seen by space and ground-based detectors. So two parameters enter this calculation. One is the bubble nucleation rate per unit volume, and the other one is the jump in energy density that is experienced by the order parameter, that is this phi here. Okay. So now, one of the most studied transition is the electroweak phase transition, especially because also of biogenesis. And in this case, the temperature of the transition is around 100 GV. People have evaluated that the ratio between beta and H star, so it's of this order of magnitude. And now if you use the formula that I show you at the very beginning for the evaluation of the gravitational wave frequency for a causal mechanism, then you put the numbers inside and you get this formula for the peak of the gravitational wave frequency for this process. And it's quite interesting that when you put a temperature of 100 GV, you get frequency that are in the LISA band, okay, between 10 millihertz and 5 millihertz. And very complicated and detailed calculation have also provided the intensity of the gravitational wave spectrum that depends also on this ratio here, but also on parameters like alpha, this jump in energy, and the velocity of the bubble. And so this is the spectrum for the gravitational wave. Now, in a standard model, there is no first-order phase transition if the X mass is larger than the W mass. So people have looked at minimal supersymmetric standard model that for certain values of the X mass, there are possibilities, but the gravitational wave frequency, the intensity is lower than 10 to the minus 16 at this frequency, okay? That is lower than what LISA can see. And then people have also looked at non-minimal supersymmetric standard models, and they get here for some values of the parameters, interesting signals that can be seen. So in this plot, I'm putting everything together, and so the signal from electroweak phase transition in this non-minimal supersymmetric standard model of Apreda Maggiore Riotto can give signals that can lie in this region here. For example, people have also looked at gravitational waves that are produced in due to turbulence in the plasma where these bubbles collide. And so, especially these people here, and you can have some signals here. But of course, these predictions are not very robust. It's just an indication. But it's also interesting to look at which kind of physics we can explore. And what I found also quite interesting, although I don't know also about what is the current stage of this model, is that you can have also bubble collisions. You can have bubble collision also in an inflationary model like extending inflation, so at the end of inflation. But this is bad because we know that you produce too many inhomogeneities, and so this model was disregarded, extending inflation. But then these people proposed another model in the class of false vacuum or first-order inflation models, in which you have two fields. One field is the inflaton field that is doing slow-roll inflation, and the other field is undergoing a first-order phase transition during the slow-roll inflation. Now, if so it's important that the phase transition occurs before the end of inflation because you can dilute, I think, these inhomogeneities. And this is also good because the frequency of the gravitational wave is pushed at low frequency, and it turns out that it goes precisely in this region here. That is quite interesting. The amplitude, in this paper, they show that for some values of the parameter, the amplitude could be seen by advanced detectors. But here, I really don't know if people have explored more these models and okay, so I don't know this. If someone has comments on this,
it looks like the model that I proposed in 1990. I don't know. I didn't look at this particular paper. I don't know how it differs. It also looks very similar to the models of open inflation. If these bubbles do not, I mean, no, it's different. I don't know.
So this bubble, they have to be produced before the end of the inflation.
Yeah.
And also they have to, so their so they have to collide also.
Well, just the possibility that like an extended inflation where the rate of tunneling is controlled by, well, some other field actually by the speed of, relation between the speed of expansion of the universe and the rate of tunneling was changing because the law of gravity was changing.
Mm-hmm.
And what I suggest that the rate of tunneling may change because one of the fields will be, well, slowly rolling, and then at some stage you will tunnel rather than wait staying on there. But then the question is, where do you get this extra inflation in this model? So you must make a tunneling to the place where you still can continue rolling.
Uh-huh.
That would be pretty complicated. I mean, so I don't know without looking into the paper how they manage.
Okay. No, because what I want to point out that if you see, you take this the frequency here, no, the peak of the, depends on the temperature. Now, let's assume that beta over H star is this quantity, okay? Now, if you take as a temperature, the temperature at the end of inflation, let's say 10 to the 10 GV, or even more, I mean, not very, should not be very high because of other problems, but let's say 10 to the 10 GV, then you get here that the frequency is pushed at too high values. So in order to get a frequency that so you get a frequency that it goes here in the region of 10 to the 4, 10 to the 6. And you can push this frequency down if you have this in this model because the frequency gets an e to minus the number of foldings left. So this is why this mechanism can work in having signals in this frequency band. But everything, of course, is it depends on the parameters because it could be that the number you have to fine tune the end of the inflation with respect to the end of the first order transition. So okay, so then there were also other mechanisms like gravitational wave produced after preheating, but they lie here, and so also here is few order of magnitude away from the ground-based interferometers. So this is the situation for first-order phase transition. And now the other possibility is to produce gravitational wave from cosmic strings. And so in this case, so we know now from the data of the CMB and also from the data on smaller scales, like 100 megaparsec, that the contribution of topological defects to structure formation can be only lower than 10%. Okay. But still, cosmic strings could be interesting in producing a stochastic background of gravitational waves, as originally was pointed out by Vilenkin. Now, what I'm saying in e-transparency, it was well known, it has been well known during the last 10 years, so you can imagine that at some point in the evolution of the universe, you form a network of cosmic strings that regenerate in this way. And now you can easily evaluate the amount of gravitational wave produced just using the quadruple formula, formula here. And you evaluate the how much is radiated by the loop. Okay? And you get at the end that the number, besides this phenomenological coefficient that is something of the order of 50, goes like the Newton constant mu square, where mu is the tension of the string. And if you take strings that are produced at the God scale, then you get this order of magnitude for omega. That is quite interesting because it can be, for example, advanced LIGO or LISA could see this background. But
in one of the recent papers by Andrew Little, it was shown that from the WMAP experiment, the tentative estimate for G multiplied by mu should not be larger than 10 to the minus 7.
Yes, I know this. I'm not. I am aware of. But this was more for an order of magnitude. Also because it was not. I know about that. Because of this contribution here, that will be just 10%. That is reducing.
He said that it should be about 1%.
Yes. But actually, more than this, I wanted to point out that, on the contrary, recently, on top of this stochastic background, there should be also a background due to bursts that are produced around cusp and kinks in this network of cosmic strings. And this background has been investigated and discovered by Damour and Vilenkin. And it's much more interesting than the other one because it's much more higher, and also it gives important results, also varying g mu, the parameter g mu. So what happened is that these cuffs or kinks, you can have an emission, very strong emission of gravitational waves. And in this plot, this is the amplitude of the burst. The burst is known as a function of the frequency. They have worked out it. So you can do some much filtering techniques to detect it. And at the optimal frequency of 150 Hz, this is the amplitude that you get for cusp if only one cusp is formed in one oscillation, and if one cusp is formed after in 10 oscillations, okay? And this is from kinks, while the stochastic background is lying here. So the stochastic background is obtained doing an average on all these bursts. But sometimes there are bursts that are very, very energetic, and this gives these signals. Actually, the ratio between these two points gives the signal-to-noise ratio that you can have assuming optimal matching with LIGO 1 or LIGO 2. And the interest is that you get this signal for a very large region of variation of G and mu. And the same thing you can have also with LISA. So if you take a frequency that is 10 to the minus 3, then this is the result for cusp and kinks. And this is actually the level of noise with one sigma of LISA. Okay. So the last thing I wanted to say is about is actually not really gravitational wave from the early universe, but is can we use also gravitational wave to estimate the cosmological parameters? Because I think this is a very nice idea, and although again is not for the is more for the really future, so it's not. Now, it's not even for LIGO 2 or, okay, it's maybe in 10 years, I don't know. Okay, so here the idea is the following. So it was realized some time ago by Schultz originally that binaries that are system made of black holes can be used as standard candles. So these binary systems are made of black holes that spiral in toward each other. They lose energy because of the emission of gravitational wave, and then they coalesce. Okay? And the gravitational wave signal in time is given by this expression here at lowest order in the so-called post-Newtonian expansion. And so there is the dependence of the distance, dl, between us and the binary. And this luminosity distance depends on the on the redshift and on the cosmological parameters. There is some dependence on the orientation of the detector with respect to the binary in the sky. Phi is the orbital phase of the in the center of mass of the system. And the amplitude, of course, of the signal depends on phi dot, so increases as the two bodies approach each other. And that depends also on the masses of the binary system. Okay. Now, if you use three ground-based interferometers, or LISA itself alone, because LISA is moving in the sky, you can determine the location of the binary, its parameters, the cosmological distance also, but you don't get the redshift, because all the quantities that appear in the signal, they are all multiplied by the redshift. So to disentangle to get the redshift, what you can do is that you can use some electromagnetic counterpart. For example, we know that for neutron star black hole systems, it could still be true that gamma ray burst could have been emitted by after the coalescence of neutron star black holes in the case of short burst, not long burst. But for short burst, this could be an explanation of the gamma ray burst. So this could be an electromagnetic counterpart, just to make an example. Okay. So the redshift you get because from the electromagnetic counterpart, and you can identify the galaxy around it, and then from that you get the redshift. Okay. Now, actually, it's also so independently of the evaluation of the redshift, you can get the luminosity distance. But if you use, for example, LISA, the luminosity distance is not very good, because in order to get the location in the sky very accurately, you have to, the signal-to-noise ratio has to be very high. And this you can do only if you integrate for a long time the signal in your detector, okay? But if you know the redshift, you can increase the accuracy in the determination of the luminosity from this value to this value. So very interesting. But also here, there is always... So for example, this is a plot that I took from the paper of Holz and Hughes. For example, this is a binary of 10 to the 5 solar masses at a redshift of 1. This is for LISA. And this is the and here is a simulation in which you have simulated many binaries at this distance with this mass, changing the orientation in the sky of them and the orbital parameters, and you get this distribution. And the accuracy for that you can obtain the luminosity distance is this. So it's quite nice, but there is the problem of the gravitational lensing also here. And indeed, in this plot, they show that if you want to extract the cosmological parameters like omega and omega m, these are the ellipse, for example, for SNAP using 3,000 supernovae. And this is what you can get using just two gravitational wave sources if you don't include the lensing. So these are really very, very precise candles. From the point of view of the candles, these are very good candles. But the problem is that if you include the lensing effect, then the accuracy in the determination of the parameters become worse.
Why is lensing worse? Because you only have two events, so
it's yeah, like yeah. So if you have many events, then you will reduce this effect. And indeed, at the moment, and also when Daniel Holz was here last week, we were discussing about the possibility of using, so if you don't use LISA, but you use like this third generation of interferometer, you can see binary black holes up to cosmological redshift, like 1, 2. And the event rate is really very high. It's something like actually 1 per day. That, okay, so if we think also that we have 1 per day gamma ray burst, it's not, could be that also one day, I mean, if we reach that distances, you really can have one black hole coalescence per day. And in this case, you can avoid this problem of the gravitational lensing. So we are now investigating this. Okay, so LIGO 3, it's so after the first generation of interferometer, there will be an upgrade called Advanced LIGO, that is LIGO 2. And for this, we know quite well various noises, and a lot of R&D has been done. LIGO 3 is the generation after this that should operate at the same time of LISA, so in 2012. For which some understanding, some R&D has started, but still we don't know, I mean, there is no official noise curve, and but there is investigation on this. Okay, so I cannot, I will conclude because now it's, well, there is no many, I don't think there are really conclusions. It's just that, so certainly, Rayleigh gravitational waves at large and small wavelengths, they can carry information of very high energy physics, as we have seen. But if we believe in the current theoretical predictions, we have to wait a long time. Okay, so the most promising predictions, although of course not very robust, are come from cosmic strings and the electroweak phase transitions. Because if the spectrum is flat, from inflation is flat, only like post-Lisa missions dedicated to the gravitational wave background or radically new, really new ideas for ground-based detectors could observe them. Otherwise, there are no way of doing, of measuring them, of detecting them. And with advanced gravitational wave detectors, if we believe that the universe had a pre-history with an accelerated contraction, like in these bound universe scenarios, or some non-standard era, post-Big Bang era, then you can, there are regions of the parameter space that could give signals for advanced gravitational wave detectors. But for this, especially for the bound universe scenario, we really need much more robust predictions. Coming mainly also from high energy physics, like string theory, as we discussed for this the bound scenario. And unfortunately, I mean, the CMB satellites can also provide detect gravitational waves, but here there is the problem of gravitational lensing that has to be also solved. So this is the situation.